This segment is brought to you by Audit Shield, the service that protects CPA firms when the CRA comes calling, ensuring every hour you spend responding to audits or reviews is fully covered.
Welcome to our AJAG PD Pod, the place for discussion, debate, and learning about all things accounting. Our hosts, Ivan Tabak, Jonathan Tucker, are CPAs that have been in practice for more than 3 decades. Together, they bring varying experience and viewpoints to the table, not to mention a little humor, too. Join us as we talk through current issues and hot topics, tap into expert guest insights, and enjoy the odd walk down AJAG memory lane. Before we begin today's podcast, please note, although the educational material within the podcast has been carefully prepared, none of the persons involved in the preparation of the material accepts any legal responsibility for its contents or for any consequences arising from its use. As well, the podcast material and the references contained therein may reflect laws and practices that are subject to change. Advice regarding a particular fact or situation should always be reviewed by a qualified professional. This podcast is produced and distributed by AJAG Professional Development. For more information about AJAG or any of its offerings, please visit ajag.ca.
Welcome to AJAG PD Pod Season 2, Episode 9. I'm Ivan Tabak.
I'm Jonathan Tucker.
And today we'll be talking about the big, beautiful bill and the implications to CPAs and their clients. Today we have Mark Feigenbaum to guide us through it. Welcome, Mark.
Well, welcome. Thanks so much for having me on. I'm very excited to be here, and you don't usually hear about that for tax topics, but I'm actually really excited to talk to you guys about this kind of thing.
Well, great. Good to see you again.
So why don't you just give us a little brief bio of yourself, where you're at, where you're working, and then we can get into the topic.
All right. So I work at KPMG in their law office. They have a law firm, and I'm a lawyer in Canada and the U.S., and I'm a CPA in Canada and the U.S., and my practice involves usually cross-border tax, wills and estates, some immigration, some family law, just things that involve both countries usually, and a lot of my clients are in sports entertainment, so I deal with a lot of cross-border issues with them as well, and it's kind of fun.
Excellent. So tell us about the big, beautiful bill.
Yeah.
It's something we've heard about in the news, but I don't know how many CPAs actually know what the implications are to U.S. residents or U.S. citizens living in Canada and what they need to know or what we need to know.
Sure. And the name is just fantastic. So we have to start with that. Each innocuous, but I can just picture someone going, this is one big, beautiful bill. And it actually is like 1,200 pages too, which helps with that. But what's really neat about it has a little bit of everything for everybody. And a lot of it was to help domestic people, which don't really affect us too much. So a U.S. citizen in Canada pays taxes if they were resident of the U.S. and in the same way. But we get a credit for the Canadian taxes paid. And well, for some people, unfortunately, our Canadian tax rates are so much higher, so they weigh about the U.S. tax. So reducing your U.S. tax isn't going to make any difference in the bottom line for you. So a lot of the fun things that are in there are good if you lived there and didn't have Canadian tax, but don't have a lot of effect. But some things are really good that just from a policy standpoint, like they are going to, for a certain amount, there's no tax on tips. There's no tax on overtime for certain criteria, which is kind of neat. There's interest deductibility on car loans, which is interesting for certain amounts. And
that's new. That's been
implemented. Yeah, these are all new things that are available. And I think I like to study tax policy sometimes, and I find it interesting how the motivation why they do that. And unfortunately, it doesn't help us so much, but maybe someday our government will look to see, that really good. Then they'll have to raise taxes here anyways, to make up for that. It's a really interesting thing. Their tax rates, the brackets stayed the same, but the one of the big issues with the bill and why it needed to come in is because some of the reductions and deductions or everything were temporary. And the way bills work in the U.S. is they're generally like, we're going to do this for our mandate or and then they're going to expire and go back the way it was. And some bills have to actually by law end up the 10 years and so forth. And so this this legislation then makes those permanent. So a good chunk of it wasn't anything new, but now it's going to be permanent and people don't have to worry that, like, the tax rates and things like that the tables are permanent for now, unless they get overwritten by new law.
So with those different provisions that come into force for a short period of time, then expire, then get replaced with something else, it must make it really confusing and complicated to as returns that hit those things.
Yeah, exactly. It's hard sometimes to plan for long term when something expires. We had that happen with the estate tax a while ago, where they had the law said there was a increased exemption over the years, but that was going to expire in 1 year and then go back to the original one. And so people were this was in 2010, they were grasping, now it's December, it's going to go back. And there was no permanent thing. And I thought, well, they're going to have to make something permanent. They're not going to go back to 2000 again all of a sudden. And in December of 2000, and then it's when they made it permanent. So it's sometimes you're right to the end when they do that. This helped a lot in that way. In that way is to make these things permanent. And some of them are really good deductions and are good for the people there, especially lower income people that it affects.
So in this particular legislation, is this permanent, or are there parts of that are permanent and parts of it that are?
Yeah, it's permanent. They could obviously, the next, Congress, House of Representatives, when they make tax law, they could obviously just make a new one at some point in the future. But right now, with the way the political leaning of each of the houses is the same, it's going to be harder for them to override until, well, there's another election coming up. So it could go any way, but for now it's a little bit more stability in what they have.
Any major shifts? Like, you've talked about some of the nice practical features, but any big shifts in this legislation?
Well, there was a big one that was more of maybe a little bit more on the spiteful side, is they were angry at countries that had the digital services tax.
Oh, right.
And so they made a provision in there for foreign companies that would, they've been very biased for Canada and other countries. And we were pretty panicked about it. And at the last minute, they took off the tax. And the last minute, they pulled that section of our bill, like very last minute, because that would have been dramatic. They were going to override the tax treaty and increase withholding taxes, and it would have been devastating for cross-border business. But thankfully, it got through. And there's a couple other provisions for foreign businesses that we have to look at. Some good, some bad. It's a very complex area, across border international tax, with how businesses work and how profit inside businesses is taxed for foreign people. And so they've made some complex changes in that way. And like I said, some good and some bad.
So is there anything in particular, we'll say the typical U.S. citizen living in Canada should be aware that's included in this bill?
Or any changes to planning that we might have done that need to be taken into account?
Not really. It would affect more the residents of the U.S. that aren't residents of Canada. Corporate planning, we have to definitely take into account the different what we call controlled foreign corporations rules of a person owning a U.S. person owning a Canadian corporation, for instance, and how the earnings are inside them and dealt with, and that's part of the bill that we have to understand for the planning more. And but otherwise, I think it's spectacular, all the things that they did. And it really depends on anyone's situation, whether it affects them or not.
So, for example, my practice has a lot of doctors, a U.S. doctor living in Canada. Anything different, just to make it practical?
No,
there's a corporation, so they practice through a corporation. So that's the...
Yeah, we get a lot of calls about the various professions that now have corporate structures they're allowed. And a lot of practitioners say, you just can't do it. And that's not necessarily true. That's the easy answer.
Yeah.
But the actual thing is, you can do it. There's a lot of reporting that has to happen, with severe penalties for not reporting that.
Right.
And there could be potential issues with... money that's left in the corporation and that's reinvested, and if you don't take that investment income out, then it could become problematic. So you have to manage it. It's not you can't do it, and you have to manage it. And there's a lot of Canadian tax advantages. I think sometimes we have to focus on not just discounting for the U.S. side. You're a U.S. citizen, and we shouldn't do this, but there's some really good Canadian tax advantages. Look at the corporate tax rate and small business.
I guess the thing for me, though, Mark, that scares me off is the penalties.
stateside. I mean, they're huge. You fail to report a form, it's $50,000 penalty. It's like, well, that's huge.
Yeah, that's scary and missing something and they're not terribly forgiving about it.
And so they enforce those large penalties?
Yeah, I had a case a while ago where the person got a large number of penalties and I went to court and then I actually petitioned the Supreme Court of the U.S. to try to get it up.
Really?
They denied the application. And it was, the guy made maybe 50 grand a year and it's $120,000 penalty. And so they're very forgiving on that. They want to know the information. And these forms that you're talking about, the penalties have no tax.
No. It's just information. Form. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
And there's some provisions that you can go voluntarily back and fix them. There's programs you can do that. And so we encourage them. People who put their head in the sand and say, I don't want to do this kind of stuff. They're the ones that are going to be in trouble at some point. And it bothers some people having to give this information, especially there's a form that you have to disclose any bank accounts or financial accounts in the FBAR form. And people are very disturbed by giving that information or whatever. And I don't know what they do with it. There's millions of them, but they don't want to do that. But there's a very large penalty for not doing it.
Yeah. Well, it's becoming more and more, that full disclosure is becoming not just a U.S. phenomenon now. I mean, we have it here, right? So I think with technology, governments are going to request it more and more, and we're just going to have to get used to this new transparent culture that we haven't been used to in the past.
Yeah, I think there's been more cooperation amongst the countries and giving information up.
Yeah.
And you've seen that with the banking rules here too, that they're willing to give it up. And you know, you go back to when these forms, I know the FBAR form, it started around 95, I think, or something, around where I was starting. And it was paper-based and it went to a big place in a vault somewhere. Nobody thought about it. And then, you know, you did it or not. No, but now it's electronic. They know you did it or not. And it's a computer that prints out the penalty. It's no human that sits there and goes, let's give the guy a $100,000 penalty. So then you have to start fighting it. And it's just easier. I tell people it's just easier to do the forms and not
worry about it.
I mean, I have a lot of pushback sometimes with U.S. Clients or U.S. citizens, and they don't want to provide certain information, and whether it be the FBAR or whether it be just reporting some income. And, you know, aside from the Canadian perspective, they tell me how is Canada ever going to know about the U.S.? And I said, they trade information.
Yeah.
I've seen one case so far where I got a letter from CRA saying they were advised by the IRS that there was X amount of dollars of interest income earned in this and this account, and, you know, explain it, et cetera.
So I did
see it happen once. So I can't be the only one.
Yeah.
So it is happening, and clients have to learn to take responsibility for their income and pay up.
I always say, if I got a dollar for every person, I said, how would they know? I would be able to retire now here. Yeah. But everyone's like that. But they do. And I've gotten two cases now where the one country, each of them is enforced owing balances owing through the other country, which is part of the system.
It is part of the treaty?
They said that, and they took their refunds in another country, and the treaty has specific situations where it happens, but they have. And they're going to start doing that. The CRA is always for, not always, but for the last several years has asked for copies of the U.S. tax returns. If you're going to make a tax, foreign tax credit, and they want the transcript.
Yeah.
And they.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, and particular transcripts. It isn't.
Yeah. We copy of the return. It used to be sufficient.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now
it used to be the honor system. And then it moved from there.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
And the transcripts that they want, the actual IRS doesn't provide, and they want them in a time period that isn't possible for the IRS. And we could discuss that.
I tell every one of my clients, you know what, this is not going to go smoothly. CRA is going to ask for your U.S. return and a specific form. So you'll get the foreign tax credit eventually, but it won't be easy.
Yeah.
I don't know if you...
And I'm finding this year, especially, almost every single file that I claim the foreign tax credit is getting a review letter.
Oh,
whether it's $100 or $4,000,
yeah.
If you claimed it, I seem to be getting...
No, I'd be the same boat. Yeah. Anything like that.
Yeah. The last several years I get there from every single one. It's just, it's an automatic.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was part of a group that went to CRA and said that, you know, how much, you know, for all the administration you're causing, and they claimed that it was a massive amount of money they're getting from this and everything. And the part of the group were to the very largest people that did returns in Canada, and nobody had ever been denied $1 at the end of the day. So, right. So I don't know how much this is really,
I guess they're getting money for people who are doing their own returns and not replying to these letters or not knowing how to reply.
Yeah. The reassessments are pretty good size, and then it freaks the clients out. And then we're like, we just have to wait it out.
Yeah. I want to come back to something you mentioned, Mark, just about the equivalent of voluntary disclosure in the States. So the equivalent for our voluntary disclosure program, talk a little bit about that. What are the options if people find themselves in a situation where they need some relief?
Sure. When they started with the enforcement of foreign reporting, they, like long, long time ago, they really didn't mind. They're focused on the best of people and citizens had their own things going on. And then all of a sudden the government said, wait a second, there's a lot of citizens around the world that aren't reporting their income or whatever. So they started this, and they created history and policy is there was a several people they discovered had a lot of money that hadn't reported income in the US. And so they wanted these people to flush them out. So they created this program that they would be able to voluntarily come in. There was a penalty and everything, but then they would be able to get them out. What happened was there was a mass amount of people in the world were using the program. They didn't even think about that. The people who originally wanted, I believe, didn't ever come forward, but that just became a snowball. That's when they started thinking, hey, how many people are out here that didn't do it? So they created this program, and you had to pay, like I said, a penalty of X percent of the unreported income or so forth. And then over the years, they changed it to be no penalty. And you just have to do, if you qualify for the program, you have to do back 3 years of tax returns and 6 years of the financial reporting, and then get into the program and you're good and you're back up to date. And you can do that once, because what happens sometimes clients don't do the next year. Then we're back to where we started.
Yeah.
But it's a good program, and recommend people go into it. And there's a lot of people that had no idea that they even had to file, and they didn't even know sometimes they were citizens. I had somebody that was 20, they were 20 minutes in the US, and that was it. And they were born, and then they arrived, it was at the border, and then they put them in a hospital, right? Rushed to the hospital in Canada. And then, but they got their citizens Yeah, so they're discovering that to do this program, and then it should be all fine.
Similar criterion to our VDP program?
Yeah, they just haven't had, they can't be the ones that asked you first.
Yeah, of course.
And you have to have been outside the U.S. And there's other programs if you were inside the U.S. And then you can do them just for the forms that you say that have the penalties. It lets you have the filing returns, but didn't know about these forms. You can do this program to get out of the penalty for those ones.
And state a municipal or city, is that all covered by this or
no? 50 states, the district, and 50 sets of rules. They all have their own legislature, their own rules, but generally somebody who lives in Canada wouldn't be filing a state return anyways, because they would have to have state source income. So you file it, you're a resident of the state. And so you file a state return on your worldwide income as a resident of the state. If you're non-resident of the state, it only goes by state source income, which would mostly be real estate. And so if you hadn't been filing like rental returns from your property, that's a bad thing. But unless it's one of the states that have no state income tax. But they, and some of the states don't follow the U.S.-Canada tax treaty, which makes it worse. And so some don't allow a foreign tax credit in the state return. And it's really interesting work to specialize in that.
Yeah, I guess it would be.
What about state sales taxes? I've heard that has become an issue, especially for, in some cases, where Canadian companies are doing business in the state. Some of that revenue could be subject to the state tax. And I have never once seen a client charge it. And I've often mentioned it, and we've had set up meetings with different advisors, but I've never seen anything implemented by a Canadian company to charge a state sales tax. So
sales tax is a whole other layer of tax that is by usually county facts of a state. And the general rule, they don't have like a value added tax that we have. It's on products for the most part. And it's when you ship a product out of the state, that's generally not subject to the sales tax. And like it used to be the old PST here. And you're exempt. And if you're buying stuff for resale, you give them a certificate, a resale certificate, and you don't pay the sales tax on that. And so when you when you used to sell things, then you created a nexus, what they call it. So it's kind of the word for connection, created a nexus in that state where your warehouse is or whatever, and anything outside of that nexus zone then had no sales tax. And some of the online retailers came and they were able to sell to all the states and have no sales tax. And some of the local businesses were saying that we were at a disadvantage. And people like Walmart would say that we have a nexus in every state because we have a store in every state. We're never selling out of a state. So when you come to buy a coffee cup and it's $2 plus tax, but you could buy it for $2 no tax online, we're at a disadvantage. And so the state went against this company Wayfair, which sells online stuff, and there's a very big case on that, and whether the state was able to charge. And a lot of the states have generated rules relating to online sales that if you make X number of online sales into that state, you're subject to collect sales tax. And remember, the sales tax isn't come out, out of your pocket. It's just collecting it and remitting it. Unless you don't collect and remit it, then it's out of your pocket because you can't go to every client and say, "Can you give me," or every customer and say that.
Yeah.
And so, and some of it's very low threshold. You make one sale to that state and all of a sudden you owe sales tax to that state. And so you really need a good professional. One good thing about Amazon is they take care of that for certain membership levels or whatever, that they'll monitor which state, because they have warehouses and all these kinds of states that would have nexus in them. But if you're on your own selling stuff, especially from Canada, you need to sort out which states you're going to have to collect from. And then there's also something called use tax, that if you didn't charge sales tax, it has to be paid at the place of receipt of because you're using the product that didn't have sales tax. And a lot of states have that too. So it's a very interesting area that you need to, I would advise someone get a specialist in sales tax to do.
So have you had any cases where Canadian companies have been operating in the U.S.? Maybe not with a physical location, but again, just, selling into the U.S. In different states where they've been caught.
Yeah, I went to court in California. The company that they were, I talked about how would they know. The state audited one of their customers and looked at an invoice and saw there was no sales tax on the invoice. So they went back to the supplier in Canada and they wanted, and then they started auditing them and they never charged tax on absolutely anything. Oh, no. And they wanted, and then they called some of their, there's a more industrial company, wasn't to individual people. And they called some of the clients, like, "Can you give me the sales tax?" And got hung up on why would somebody do that? So then we went to court to try to get there were some other technical issues why we thought they didn't have to pay tax. But yeah, it's not an unheard of thing, believe me.
And did you win?
It was actually a pretty interesting case because it was software, and we argued that the software wasn't a physical item; it was a license that you were selling.
So you didn't win.
No, I didn't. They brought in the main lawyers for the state because they didn't want to lose that one. They would have, and then they changed the law right after, making sure that it was very definitive. But you have to pay it. Those things are fun.
So these sales taxes apply only to physical goods. There is no tax on services.
Well, definitive, there's 50 states and 50,000 counties. So I'm going to say generally, because I can't think of a thing on top of my head that it wouldn't be, but it's products. And there's special rules between the states too, like for different kinds of construction. If you go between New Jersey and New York, and like it's a whole big area that you have to get.
You have to think twice about whether you want to do business in the U.S. It's got to be worth your while to do.
Or you just get the right professionals to do the work.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, it's business decisions worse than business. Yeah. You don't have the tax bill like the dollar, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So today we're unpacking the big, beautiful bill, U.S. tax legislation, and the renewed discussion that comes out of that every time a change comes out of Washington around renouncing citizenship. And so from a Canadian accounting standpoint, this has ripple effects for firms that have clients who hold U.S. citizenship or have U.S. source income. So to help connect the dots, we brought Jason in from Audit Shield to share a little bit about how these types of changes affect them. So Jason, welcome.
Ah, always a pleasure to be here.
Good to see you.
You too.
So tell us a little bit about how these types of changes roll out with Audit Shield.
Well, first, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention to you or ask you first if you've seen our big, beautiful billboard on The Gardener.
Okay.
Anyway, no, it's a great question. And while Audit Shield doesn't cover U.S. filings or IRS questions directly, it absolutely comes into play when the CRA starts asking questions about those U.S. filings. For example, we're seeing CRA inquiries where they want to reconcile Canadian and U.S. returns, you know, where a client has, say, U.S. source income, cross-border investments, or dual citizenship. And when that happens, the firm ends up having to spend hours gathering all the information the CRA is asking for. And as you know, it can be very time consuming. And that's when Audit Shield comes into play to make sure that all of that time where the CRA is looking for question or looking for information around the IRS, that time is fully recoverable through us.
And what about when it's the other way around? When the IRS is asking for information and firms are now assisting your clients with that?
So if the question is not originated from the CRA, it would not be covered. But to be a little bit clearer, as I say, because of all the cross-border the questions for non-business tax and that sort of thing, we see a lot of questions from the CRA relating to those U.S. tax filings. So as mentioned, that kind of work would be covered.
And for people that have been watching this podcast, that was one of the topics that we talked about, is the fact that oftentimes CRA is now asking taxpayers for their U.S. tax return. And so firms end up spending time getting that information, which is all billable time. And so that's becoming more and more common.
Yeah, and to that point, John, and just to build on it, the CRA is paying a lot more closer attention to cross-border reporting, foreign income verification, the T1135 and disclosures. And, you know, that's really part of a much broader wave of CRA activity that we're seeing right now. To give you a snapshot, the top areas of scrutiny that we're tracking include personal tax matching programs. Obviously, the CRA is comparing T-slips and flagging and even the smallest of discrepancies. We're seeing a lot of vehicle and travel expenses right now, a lot more reviews, especially for professionals and corporate clients. Professional fees, advertising deductions. CRA is looking for a lot more detailed support. GST, HST has been something we've been seeing all year, pre and post assessments. Particularly for consultants, contractors, and digital service providers. And as I mentioned, foreign income reporting, T1135s, U.S. holdings, and offshore activity is very much on their radar.
And that's not going away, Jason. We're finding more and more, as you and I have talked about, besides more and more work post-tax season where there's inquiries coming up. So
it's very true. I mean, just in the last month, we saw a 20% increase of the number of notice of assessment letters as compared to last September. And also the depth of information that the CRA is asking for has certainly increased over the last few months.
Yeah. And unfortunately, what we're finding is that with this, clients' frustration level increases. And so their sense of trust diminishes because they get the sense, oh, you know, have you not done your job properly?
Yeah. And you know what? The new reality is that the CRA is a lot more active, as we know. In fact, I was in a conversation last week where somebody remarked on the fact that there's now three guarantees in life. There's death, there's taxes, and you can be guaranteed that you're going to receive a call from the CRA. And that's where we have you covered. So in the event of a review, audit, or investigation, send the bill to us and your client has peace of mind.
Yeah.
Because the fact is, the CRA is certainly a lot more active.
Yeah, yeah. Well, always great to have that perspective, Jason. Thanks. And thanks to Audit Shield for supporting today's episode, as well as supporting firms by helping them convert their least recoverable time into chargeable time. And Jason, how do people get in touch with you?
Well, we've got the URL at the bottom of the screen, but also give us a call. My colleague Jen books appointments, and we're happy to run you through an overview. Her number is 437-800-5766.
Excellent. Thank you. Thanks, everyone. So I had a client today, U.S. citizen, wants to renounce doesn't want to file tax returns. You must hear this a lot.
A lot.
Yeah. And to my mind, I would not want to give up a citizenship. This person seems to think there's, you know, the cost and the inconvenience of having to do so. And doesn't not making a lot of money. You try to talk people out of this?
I let them look at the non-tax reasons. Again, are they going to want to retire there? Are they going to want to, their kids want to go to school there? Are they going to want to do business? Like, it's just so, and you have to use the U.S. citizen line at the airport, which right now actually is empty, but they, you know, there's a lot of factors that are non-tax related. And for people who don't really have any of these controlled for corporation things or an estate tax issue or whatever, it's really just filing the returns and paying no tax. There is a tax that was a problem. It's called the net investment income tax, where you're not allowed to use your Canadian tax credit against it as a tax on capital gains, dividends, rents, royalties, and something. So people sometimes did have to write a check for that, depending on your income level, and that aggravated a lot of people. But the court now said you might be able to use your Canadian tax against it. That being said, I think that people are very focused, and in fact, it's an administrative problem, not having a money problem.
Yeah, right.
I don't know, personally, giving up a citizenship.
Yeah.
Now, people have ideological reasons, and yeah, I might talk about that too.
Yeah. No, I couldn't imagine a scenario where I would give up my dual citizenship. I guess maybe if it was a political thing or something. In other words, if you ran for it and it became, but I have no, I just wouldn't do it.
For people who do go ahead with the renunciation, what are the U.S. tax implications to that? I had heard that there was some type of an exit tax that's triggered, but I really don't know anything about it. So they enlighten us.
They don't usually have deemed taxes like we have when you die or things like that. But this case there is, because the U.S. again wouldn't have any more chance to tax you. So they get one last, and there's a historical reasons for doing that. And they pretend you sold your assets, but there's a number of exceptions and whatnot. And then they give you a credit against around $700,000 or so against what the taxes. So it's possible that you would have an exit tax.
But wiped out by the exemption.
Or you're over. But then there's various reasons where you aren't what's called a covered expatriate. And it's a little bit more complicated. That's again why it's not a do-it-yourself project a little bit.
Yeah.
It depends on someone's facts and circumstances, whether this would apply even at all. And if it does, and you have to think of that, you aren't just go willy-nilly and renounce citizenship and find a lady. You shouldn't have done that because you aren't getting it back.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I presume that exit tax, if they actually have to write the check, is not creditable in Canada. Because there wouldn't be any matching.
Well, it'd be on Canadian source too. Like it's on.
Right. But if you have a deemed disposition of an asset, there's no Canadian tax to offset
that. That's right.
So that would be a pure cost.
Yeah. And so it's pretty rare someone wants to renounce that the exit tax, expatriation tax it's called, applies to them at this pre-unusual.
Yeah.
That usually would scare them off. The cost to renounce used to be very, very, very small. And then they realized that it cost them incredibly few number of people were renounced until they started enforcing the tax, foreign tax rules.
Yeah.
Like very, very small handful. And now it became popular to do that. So they raised the cost to cover their costs of doing it. And that usually scared off not people. It's only a few $1,000s, but they didn't want to pay for a tax return for that. So they're not going to pay for renunciation. It also used to be much more difficult. You had to go to multiple interviews with the State Department and stuff. And now you can do it at a counter. They had to streamline the process but also too, make it people make it out like there's a lineup outside to do them. It's still not that common to give up your citizenship. Yeah. The backlog, depending on the consulate you're at, could be substantial. And so people fly to places to just get them quicker done it. Wow. That are eager to do it.
Wow. So I wanted to move into estate planning because sometimes that's an issue that we face with clients as well. And in light of the big, beautiful bill, anything estate planning, changes that we need to take into account or make people aware of?
Well, the estate planning for cross-border is complex and definitely needs to be reviewed because rules, that the things that we do in Canada are just not allowed for tax purposes in the U.S. Yeah. And things you do in the U.S. aren't allowed for Canada. So to have a Canadian resident, U.S. citizen, to do estate planning, like it's doing a estate freeze on their company, that's very bad for U.S. tax purposes. So we have to really watch for that. And they taxed on a different basis. They tax on fair market value and we tax on gain. And so there's differences. We were mentioning about credible taxes, but weren't for the treaty, that wouldn't be credibles, but under the treaty it is. And there's in the U.S. a overriding exemption, which back in the 90s was $600,000 exemption. So now it's a $15 million or something close to that. It goes up by inflation all the time. And so that wipes out a good swath of the population of that. And then under the Canada-U.S. treaty, if you leave everything to your spouse, you could get an additional exemption for that. So that again cleans most of that out. And there's a lot of estate planning techniques. That's what I specialized in. And the walls full of still paper books of just planning techniques and to get out of this. It's a very onerous tax. It's about half of the value of everything you have. So you want to make sure it is well worthwhile if you have beyond the exemption amount to make sure you're not paying that.
Yeah. People shouldn't just assume. I have a client, fairly wealthy woman, $15, $20 million, and decided she wanted to buy a condo in Florida, and just went ahead and did it and didn't get any advice. So, you know.
The U.S. estate tax applies to non-citizens as well, and the fact that they have U.S. assets, which are real property in the U.S. or shares of U.S. corporations, wherever they're held. And so people, don't think about that or they put their kids on the title for, whatever the property, and then there could have gift tax implications. And, I tell people that they just ask me first. It's a one-line email. I'm going to give it to you now, and I'll say, don't feel that now.
Yeah.
Before you go and buy a plan, like just ask.
Yeah.
What about wills? I've had some cases with U.S. citizens and Canadian wills, and it especially became apparent when we were looking at the trust filings and advising them about creating trusts through the wills, etc. And some of them had wills prepared in the U.S. or by U.S. lawyers because of their citizenship, and some of the provisions were really different. Let's put it that way, than Canadian laws that I had ever run across. So I had to do some digging and understand it. So what would a U.S. citizen preparing a Canadian will need to pay attention to?
All right. And I'm going to take a little bit of a step back and talk about the trust you're probably thinking about for a U.S. person. They try to get out of probate like we do here. Their probate's significantly less than our Ontario, but one of the ways is they can create a what's called a grantor trust. And grantor trusts are ignored for tax purposes. It's as if you put it in a separate bank account, except for at the moment of passing, it becomes a actual irrevocable honorary trust, and sort of exempt from probate because it passes outside of the will. So it's very common that everyone does that. It's very inexpensive to do. If a Canadian person did that, we know our trust, having a revocable trust in Canada, very bad. So when someone's moving to Canada, we tell them get rid of that. So if their wills were done with that kind of planning that had revocable, that would be more before they die kind of planning. So we have to look at that. In the will having testamentary trust, there has to be consideration that there might be U.S. citizen trustees or U.S. citizen beneficiaries. And this all can be worked around, especially with the will. You can work the wording out because the person hasn't died yet. And there's some great planning we can do if you have a U.S. citizen married to a non-citizen, and in the will having that property exempt from estate tax, for instance, by utilizing trust inside the will and having some specific wording. So those are the kinds of things I'd look at, is what the trustees, citizenship or residency, the beneficiaries, and whether we can use spousal trust appropriately. The other thing I would give an advice to, which is not often given, but from the legal side, is your executor of your will. Having a non-resident executor of the will creates a lot of problems later in probating the will. And so we try to recommend someone have it, or if they make it multiple ones, have the U.S. person resign when the person dies.
I have had a couple of cases where it was two siblings that were appointed co-executors. One of them was a U.S. resident, and that one in all the cases I've had had resigned.
Is it automatic?
No, it's automatic, but they decided that, after looking at it, the U.S., it was just too onerous.
And you have to post a bond or go to court, get out of the bond, or it's just a very expensive thing. And so we try to do that as a tip for people. The other thing is when you don't know sometimes if your beneficiaries are going to move to the U.S. And so you need to update the will. People just don't up their wills. They have wills for the kids who are now 40, right? And while you're still capable of signing it, you should go through them and look. And that way you can tweak it, knowing that your daughter now married to someone in the U.S. and this would have to be written in that way.
Is there specific trust filings in the U.S. like there are here? I've never run across one.
Yeah, there's a 1031. But again, if it's a grantor trust, you don't need to. So it would be a non-grantor trust, which I can see why you hadn't run into them, because that would be an irrevocable U.S. trust.
Right.
Now for the Canadian, it's foreign trust filings, which you probably have done 3520 forms and everything. So. Which have massive penalties for not filling that ones out. So watch for those if they're needed. It's a complicated, but I look at it this way, they have 200 million tax returns. They need to sort everything out by forms and make it easy for them to run around, not to defend them, but it's very regimented of the things you have to file.
Yeah. So the planning around registered accounts and things like that, there's not been any recent changes for individuals.
In the treaty or administratively, the RSP is fine still. TFSA, advisors say don't use the TFSA if you're a U.S. citizen, but you have to look back and say, well, it's a really good tax planning thing.
Yeah.
So the consequence is that you have to report the income each year, but how much income is it? Maybe it's all capital undeclared capital gain.
It's not they
unrealized capital gains or something. Yeah. That's not any income anyway. Yeah.
So it's more an issue of cost of reporting. That's
and if they have a lot of interesting or something, you have to have enough canned tax to cover it, which outside of the plan. And so there could be some issues with that. And then just to add to is certain states that don't follow the treaty, there might be some, if you're a resident of those states that still have a RSP, for instance, that might be a problem. But these are remote problems for people. And I would really look at your Canadian tax planning and see how those things fit in and not just discount some things because they're USs. Yeah.
So it's the RRSP that is recognized by the US, but TFSA, FHSA, and RESPs?
Yeah, there's nothing in
the DSPs?
Yeah, there's nothing in the law.
Nothing. So those would be flow-throughs or
not. Just like calling them, but
reportable.
Any income from them would just be in the U.S. But as I said, our taxes are much higher here. So sometimes have excess credit, but it has to be depending on the source of the income and stuff.
Now, are there any U.S. similar type plans that are not recognized by Canada? You'd have to pick up the income out of U.S. registered plans?
Well, they have an IRA, which is like our RRSP.
Right.
They have Roth IRA, which is like our TFSA, but it's the same situation. And then they have a deferred compensation plan, which is commonly known as a 401k, which basically you've elected to not have some of your pay go, and it goes into a fund, and you get it, when you want it back again, and the companies usually match it and things like that. So that could be an issue. But people have sometimes the opportunity to put money into them, and they think, oh, this is great or whatever as a Canadian. But again, reducing your U.S. tax is not going to help you a whole lot. So we try to, where these come into play is when somebody comes with them from U.S. to Canada that already had these plans. Mm-hmm. It's fairly unusual or not terribly tax efficient for someone in Canada to contribute to U.S. plans at all.
Mm-hmm. But if they come to Canada having had an existing plan, we should be looking to pick up the income from within those plans in Canada?
Depending on the plan that they have. And you could, there's provisions to be able to roll those plans into other, like mm-hmm. each one's kind of different. And,
right.
And you have to look at whether, because there's withholding tax sometimes I'm doing that. And yeah. each plan is a separate follow ax. And then it might be better just to collapse that plan and just depending on the growth you have in there and it depends. There's a treaty reduction in the tax you'd have to pay on getting payments from the plans. And so, you're subject to a maximum tax from the U.S., but you have to put it into your Canadian income. So when your Canadian income is very low and paying the max tax U.S., you might end up better just pulling out the money. So I think the moral is that everybody has their own situation. There's no cut and dry, don't do this if you're U.S. citizen, don't do this, and so on and so forth.
So just ask.
ask. Or email.
Yes.
Well, as we come to the end of our podcast today, I wanted to ask you about the calculation you did. We were talking about this before, and you were talking about professional, was it a baseball player?
Yeah, hockey.
Hockey. And share a little bit about the complexity that you had to go through and what an athlete goes through when they play games in different places.
Okay, so this is I did a long study for about 4 months on this. I took a player, a hypothetical player, and I know you guys are Canadians now, so
yes, thank you.
And I'll say that knowing that just to everyone knows that's listening to this, I'm not.
Well, thanks very much.
I'm going to be because I deal with a lot of players on a lot of different teams. I'll say I love all of them, and people who write a check, I'm good. So I said, let's say a Canadian person, and I said, okay, they live in Montreal and they live in the area of the, cause some of them matters where you live. So I live in the area of the stadium. And then I went through the schedule that they played in the last year and then how many days they played in games in every other place. And then I worked out the tax implication of them working all those. I looked at, payroll taxes like RCPB, EI, California SDI, all these sorts of things. And then I found out the actual total tax they pay. I did an average $3 million salary. And then I figured out how much tax they pay on that $3 million. And I did it for all the every team. And so it's a big chart. It was in the Hockey News last January of all the results of that. And
so the number of tax returns an athlete who's playing in different states has to file.
Could be. And then some of the, there also could be some city tax. And that's why, again, I did it based on where the stadium was. And there could be some. One of them is based on what school zone you're in. Like it's pretty interesting. And so, yeah, I have clients that will file in 10, 15 states or whatever, depending on the schedule. And then, of course, it depends which team you're on, because some play more states. If you're on the West Coast, you have more California teams than if you're on the East Coast. And
so is it down to the extent where you play one game in a state, you would have to file a return for that state on your pro rata share of the income?
Yeah. So it goes by the way where you skate, it goes by. And so that's
that's crazy, man.
Yeah. It's very interesting. And then, for some regular person who's working on a job, it might work out to $50 if that hour that they were there, but you're making $3 million and you divide it by how many games you played. It's a fair amount. So there were some very interesting results of how, the different teams have a vast, I don't want to spoil the chart, but a vast difference in the amount of tax they pay being. And
because of the mix of states that each team.
Yeah, and our tax rate being higher here. And if you were, you played for Montreal and obviously the tax rate in Montreal is much higher than Florida. So you pay worldwide tax to your home place and then get credit for the taxes paid to the other places, but you're still have to top up for the rest of it.
But an American living in Montreal for X number of months a year, is there an argument that Montreal is that they are not a tax resident, that their predominant tax residency would be in Florida? Can that be?
Oh, yeah, of course. And I didn't. When I did this chart, I didn't take into account planning because I would think too many, and that's why you get paid. So I write an article how to do this. But that's actually what it'd be pretty unusual that someone is a resident of Montreal and playing for Montreal. And even though that sounds what
anti-quaggy view.
Right. But how would the Canadian government or Quebec government look at that?
Well,
and if they're saying, okay, you know, the season is how many months? 7 months?
Yeah.
Something like that, right? But and you have an apartment or house in Montreal, but you're only here for half the games, but you're here for other, you know, non-playing days.
Yeah, it's facts of circumstances. There, yeah, for the Monday through day, so it's facts of circumstances and what facts. A great case with Derek Jeter in the Orb, where he claimed his resident of Florida and New York State tax and city tax in Manhattan there was pretty high, and they claimed he was the same idea as that. He was read the New York State does the same facts and circumstances test, and he had a big apartment in Manhattan. His kids went to school there, you know, and it was a whole bunch of facts, and they wanted him to pay New York tax. And so similar, like you have to make sure or look at the situation that they have. But believe me, for that kind of money, they've looked at the situation.
Yeah, right. That's how I would think.
But the CRA does challenge, like they're really big on sports people right now.
Yeah, I've heard that. Yeah.
So when players are negotiating contracts, how much of an impact does the tax situation of the location of that team, the home base of the team, come into play?
Well, that's the
view. Have you ever seen that?
I don't want to discuss much about how they negotiate contracts, but there's a lot of factors, don't forget, and what team they're going to be playing for and where their family's going to be and all that sort of thing. But it has to put it through the mind of how much they're, and whether one team's going to give more than another and what's the after-tax. So a chart like this is really good, and figuring out, in a broad sense, what the tax differential is. It has to, like, I can't imagine it wouldn't play in that market.
But you haven't ever had to do a calculation for one of your clients saying, I'm thinking about going here or here.
I've had agents ask me
you've done that.
Yeah, I don't know what they did with my tab.
Right.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Mark, for your time today and for your insights and bringing us up to speed on the big, beautiful bill and all of the other little areas that we meandered to.
U.S. tax is always always a mystery.
And if people want to get in touch with you, how do they do it?
They can email me at mfagenbaum.ca, which I don't know if you have mfagenbaum@kpmg.ca, or Google me, I suppose, or
we'll put up the email.
I'm always open to email people and interested in what you guys do, and people have very interesting careers and things I'm fascinated by. And so I try to help when I can, or else I direct them to somebody who can.
Yeah, that's great.
That's great.
Well, thanks again for your time today.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you. So thanks for joining us. Please like and subscribe our channel, and we hope to see you again next time.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.